Welcome to the HSJ's Health Check Podcast. My name is Ben Clover. I'm one of the Bureau Chiefs at the HSJ. And this week I am deputising for Annabel Collins, who's on holiday. This week we've got two of my colleagues here to talk about stories that they put out this week. A really interesting range of stuff. I've got Joe Talora and Emily Townsend with me. Thanks for joining me, guys. First of all, we're going to go to Joe and a story that sort of resonates around the sort of wider media with quite a contentious company. Joe, can you tell us what's the latest with the FDP? And indeed, what is the FDP? Why have you born?
Been asked that a few times now. Yeah, so we've spoken about the FDP on the podcast a few times. So yeah, anyone that doesn't know, and there are a few people I think that still don't know, it's software that's going to bring together sort of disparate sets of data from across the NHS and bring them together into one place. Local NHS organisations will have their own instances of this platform, which they'll be able to use to compare and plan. And the idea is that it's just going to improve efficiency and make things quicker overall. That's the idea, at least. It's controversial for a couple of reasons, mainly, I think, in terms of the mainstream coverage, because of the company that's supplying the platform, Palantir. Quite a lot of coverage in the mainstream press about them and their background in the defence and sort of espionage sectors and their founder, Peter Thiel, and the comments that he's made about the NHS and things like that. So I think people are just a bit sour on that. And then from the sort of NHS point of view, there are questions over value for money and even still what it's actually going to do and what benefits it's going to deliver. So it's a contentious issue that's not going away, and I think it's one that we're going to be discussing for a while. But the most recent developments are the publication of the unredacted contract with Palantir. So this was one of the sticking points that critics had, was that when NHS England published the contract, I think 417 of its 586 pages were entirely redacted. And this was after NHS England had sort of committed to being transparent about it and getting the public on board. So there was a legal challenge launched by the legal advocacy group Good Law Project, who said, you know, quite reasonably that the public has a right to see what's in this contract and particularly around how the data is going to be protected. And so NHS England did commit to publishing that, and they did in fact do that at the end of March. It's done quite quietly. There wasn't an awful lot of fanfare, and there wasn't really any coverage of it. And having read through most of the contract, there's probably a good reason for that, which is there isn't really much in there there wasn't a smoking gun. Anyone who was expecting a big, yes, you know, Palantir are going to be looking through all your medical records and doing all this nefarious stuff, there's none of that. It's pretty much what you'd expect. Lots of legal, technical jargon, lots of regulations and things in place, which is good. You know, this is very welcome.
Yeah, it's good and what you'd expect.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I know that, you know, Good Law Project and other advocacy groups are still looking over it and considering their responses. So it may well be that something comes out that we've missed. You know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a legal background. So I was purely looking at it from a journalistic point of view. But from what I could tell, there wasn't really anything that was sort of concerning, or if anything, it was quite the opposite. The section around personal data and how that's going to be protected, that there's an awful lot of stuff in there, which I think people should be reassured by, in that Palantir are not going to be going through people's medical records and selling them off to the highest bidder or anything like that. You know, bound by law, bound by the contract, and there's lots in place there to protect it.
So data's got to stay in the UK and be summed off by a lawyer, doesn't it, before it can move anyway. But then I've been at the HSJ for 14 years now, and I've seen a lot of different IT projects come and go, where they're going, like, oh, we're going to finally knit together all of this later in the data into a series of data lakes that are going to form one giant data ocean. And it really will, you know, kind of, if you could harness all that, it really would make a difference to research. It is, but at the same time, people are justifiably worried about suddenly not being able to get a mortgage because someone has somehow managed to de-pseudonymize their data and it's found out that actually they smoked for 3 years as a student, and now, you know, and now they're a higher risk on this thing. Like, kind of, I was at a cancer conference the other day, and clinicians were saying If I had a pound for every person who said, actually, no, I don't smoke, but I can't put it on the form. And that's a real patient safety risk, because people aren't going to get, people aren't going to be called forward for their targeting lung health check screening because they've felt like they had to mislead the system. Legit, legit concern. And sorry, just because I doubt anyone who works in or near the NHS kind of would go like, oh, I absolutely love my IT setup. But to be clear, kind of most, there's the primary care world and it has its own colourful figures in its IT provision, and then in other bits of system, trusts would have their own data systems, right? But the FDP would sit alongside those, or
Yeah, so it's kind of a separate thing from EPRs or anything like that. It's the FDP. The NHS says that the FDP is a series of systems. There's the national sort of central data platform, the localized instances, which will be in every trust, and ICB is where they can pull data from the central store, use it for research and public health. I think eventually is the aim, but right now it's more about those key targets of waiting lists and optimizing patient flow and things like that. The two sort of main use cases initially will be scheduling theatre utilization and discharge and flow. And those will be the sort of localized instances of the federated data platform at every, I say every trust. I think NHS England has said the goal is it's going to be a 3-year phased approach. The first year, they're hoping to have, I think, 70 trusts on board, and that's mostly the ones that were involved in pilots and things like that, and then some others. And then those that are maybe further behind or a bit slow to adopt it will come on over the next 2 years. But yeah, that's how it's going to work essentially. And the contract doesn't really sort of shed any more light that we didn't know about that. But it did give us some interesting tidbits about the supplier and about some of the things that they're going to have to do as part of this contract. As most people know, is that any public procurement, the procuring body has to demonstrate how they're providing a social value. So we got that information from the unredacted contracts. We already knew that Palantir was going to be helping set up this data academy, boosting the skills and boosting the digital workforce, and there's not really much more about that, but we also found out that they're opening a northern hub in England in 2025, and that's how they're demonstrating their social value. So
Oh,
and
for
not
Data
even
Academy.
no so this is for Palantir themselves.
Oh, right.
So
Oh,
yeah, it's
okay. A little bit of Silicon Valley.
part of their demonstration of social value, they're opening an office hub in the north of England in 2025. And they're also providing 10 hours worth of training to NHS England leadership over equal opportunities issues and things like that. So not a massive amount, you'd say, for a £330 million contract, but well, yeah.
Yeah, and this contract was awarded. Oh, so just to get back quickly to the sort of national nature of it, because often people, when they think of the national IT program, they think of MP Fit and the Fujitsu and the long lasting effects that had on how people procure, a bit like not just IT but large systems in the NHS. But does it feel like, I don't know, it feels to me like maybe there is a case for how the centre doesn't have as good information as people thought it did. And that was really, I remember seeing Dominic Cummings speaking at the COVID inquiry and talking about how when we're in like March, April 2020, having to, on a whiteboard, write up the numbers of like critical care beds at different units. Okay. And you do, when one thinks of the centre of a massive organization, or really a set of organizations like the NHS, you sort of imagine it would be a control room that can show you all of this, and there just wasn't. It had to be put together by hand in a real hurry, obviously suboptimal. But this contract was awarded in a unusual way as well, right?
Yeah, so I mean, this almost entirely all comes from COVID. I think we learned a lot of lessons from COVID, and a big part of that was data. We had the data saves lives. policy paper in 2022, and a real commitment to harness the power of data and use that for planning and things like that. But it was during COVID that Palantir got involved with the NHS, and this is another reason why it's potentially controversial and why people are a bit hesitant around it, in that Palantir essentially during the COVID pandemic offered their Foundry platform for free. It was a £1 contract, and that was used to plan vaccination program and things like that. And then subsequently from there, they won about £70 million worth of business with the NHS in sort of unchallenged, sort of not open procurements. And again, there's no suggestion that that's illegal. You know, this just how things work. But I think people were perhaps a bit dubious of them getting involved in that way, and subsequently winning the open procurement for the Federated Data Platform, which was £330 million over the lifetime of the contract, it's estimated to be. So it was one of the reasons why people were maybe a bit sceptical of it.
Yeah, and £330 million, like, that'll run you like a DGH for a year. Or so not an insignificant amount of money. And this week, this is not the end of the interesting procurement decisions related to FDP, right? We've seen this contract for promoting it. Can you help me understand this sort of story?
Yes, so there was another contract awarded last month, which was published recently, and that was an £8.5 million contract awarded to KPMG consulting firm to promote the adoption of the FDP. So NHS England, sell this target of 70 trusts per year for the next 3 years, adopting it and taking it on. KPMG have got a handsome £8.5 million contract to support that work. So going out to trust and promoting it, I guess. This is engaging with them, creating strategies, and sort of doing the work to make sure that trusts appreciate what this might do for them, I think is the goal there.
So trusts that are having their sort of anything that's not a frontline cost kind of frozen can look forward to a visit from a graduate management trainee saying, hey, there's this thing on a shelf in SE1. We'd absolutely love it if you plugged it in here and started reporting. This is essentially, they're going to be showing you how to use it and how to...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're going to be developing training tools and things like that. And the main purpose, it seems, is to support the implementation of the FDP, and just making sure that trusts know that it's there and taking up the offer of using it. And the terms of the contract pretty much align with what NHS England has said. They say they expect KPMG to help 40 trusts adopt it in the first year. There's already about 40 trusts who have expressed an interest in doing so, or are already doing so. So that broadly lines up. But the contract's for 2 years, £8.5 million over 2 years. So yes, as with any sort of big public spend involving a consultancy, potentially a bit of controversy. But
because there are already consultancy firms involved in the initial award, right?
Yeah, that's right. So Palantir won the original £330 million contract as part of a consortium which included PwC and Cardinal Farrar and Accenture, and there's several firms involved in that procurement consortium, which I think the question has been asked, well, why aren't they doing this work? I don't know the details, so I'm sure they're supporting in their own ways, but there's a bit of a question over why we now need another separate contract for a separate consultancy firm to go out and promote the tool that's been made.
Yeah, I mean, which could suggest, is there a burning need for this product at all? Or maybe there totally is, and actually it's just a question of, in a super busy environment, you need people to actually come and help you do it, because everyone is absolutely slammed. And we're all brilliant. Thank you, Joe. Thanks for taking us through that. And I want to come to another story this week, one that really pretty scary. Emily, can you tell us about the piece you've done this week on sepsis?
Yeah, so this is a follow-up to a big investigation that we did in February. So essentially, there's been quite a big spotlight on sepsis and failures, particularly to provide prompt treatment for sepsis, primarily within emergency departments, but also by GPs and other areas of the NHS, like ambulance services, that kind of thing. And this latest one, it's just because we spotted since the beginning of March, so only within, the last 6 weeks, there have been several reports uploaded to the Prevention of Future Deaths platform, which is judiciary platform, which essentially has coroner's reports. So when a coroner is sufficiently concerned about systemic issues within a trust or Department of Health Social Care and NHS England, they'll address their concerns to the relevant organisation and flag it up. And it's called a Regulation 28 report, which I'm sure people will have heard us discuss on this before. But essentially, there's been seven warnings, but there's been six notices in total that have been sent by coroners to the various organisations and to the Department of Health and NHS England. And essentially, I think four of those were children, I think the youngest being 10 weeks old. So there's serious concern here about amongst coroners over very, very similar issues. So failure to administer antibiotics within an hour, which is the recommended time frame. I think there have been recent guideline changes to move it back slightly for less serious cases to 3 hours, but there's still a, lots of these cases go well beyond that, sometimes even up to a day. So there's real concern here about the wider problems, I guess, in the NHS in terms of sort of access, particularly in emergency departments, and their impact on conditions like this that can really cause serious harm. So sepsis, we've seen stroke, quite a similar issue, which we can discuss a little bit later. But essentially, since the beginning of March, it's quite a striking number. So six reports, and there was also an inquest that was very critical of a hospital about an 11-year-old, handling of an 11-year-old who died of sepsis as well in Norfolk. So there's a lot of high profile concern, I think, about this particular problem.
Gotcha. And I've seen from like your earlier reporting on this is like, yeah, and again, kind of pardon my ignorance on this, but kind of like sepsis is a kind of blood poisoning, right? But kind of can some people can present with it, and like the Royal College of Emergency Medicine said to you in February, it's kind of could be very hard to spot. So from your work in February, it seemed like there's not great data out there on the rates. We're relying on trusts reporting it themselves in these already very pressured environments. But your data in February seemed to show that we'd gone backwards, as far as we could tell, on the position compared to 2019, right? And this is why you mentioned kind of the parallel with stroke, because these are both urgent care pathways. Because we all read and write all the time about the delays, handover delays, kind of the 4 hour breaches, that kind of thing. But this is the actual tangible results, kind of actually going through the judicial process. And kind of, Emily, your outpatient safety report, kind of like I've seen it seemed like there's been a trend in PFDs recently where they seem more willing to identify system factors. I mean, I've seen that with like so the winter before this, the extremely difficult one. I mean, the coroners in the Southwest would quite often say, this fatality, like the Southwest Ambulance Service doesn't have the resources to address. And like, in fact, no, the system is on its own down there doesn't have the resources to address what it was facing there. Is that something you've seen like more widely? Was that just a Southwest thing?
Yeah, that's correct. So I think just to kind of address the sepsis thing in particular, I think essentially when we were with the February piece, it was very much kind of, as you said, there was until 2019, there was pretty good reporting of this data because NHS England in 2016 introduced a kind of national incentive target, so a CEQIN for trusts where they had to treat 90% of people with suspected sepsis in A&E and inpatients within an hour. And essentially they had pretty drastic good progress actually. So went up from about 54% to 80% in 2019. And that was kind of hailed as a really good thing, quite rightly, because it was, and it seems as if quite a lot of resource was put into it and quite a lot of effort was put into it. And after that, when the CQIM was dropped, but it was importantly, it was still included in the standard contract as a kind of measure that trusts should be measuring themselves in terms of quality for quality purposes. However, when we went back to 2019 and kind of asked for each trust for their performance up to 2022-23, and to our surprise, actually hardly any of the trusts came back to us, and they also weren't reporting it in board reports either. So I think we only got 40 back, and a lot of the responses that we got back from trusts that weren't able to respond was saying that actually they recorded a lot of this on paper records that they couldn't find, and it just wasn't there. And I think that was a real concern from kind of stakeholders like UK Sepsis Trust in particular, really concerned that there was this kind of huge sustained push. Sequin had a lot of good results, and then all of a sudden the performance kind of fallen backwards, and about two-thirds was kind of the average for the antibiotics being administered promptly enough, which is the big theme that came up in these coroner's reports. And I think that was the correlation, that was the concern, is that actually there are these kind of repeated failures again and again and again that are being raised by coroners. And just to address, I guess, the fact that there are more of these reports, I think, as you mentioned, the Southwest in particular, I think there's actually been another one recently. There's been kind of a couple in the Southwest, but I think there is more of a public awareness of sepsis in general, but also I think coroners are noticing. I think it's hard as well for, I think a lot of the time when coroners decide to put out a Regulation 28, they have to listen to the trust responses and to feel confident that they have addressed the problem. And I think quite a lot of these involving emergency care delays and emergency department delays, they haven't resolved the problem because it is a huge issue and it's a constant issue. And I think that's perhaps maybe a reason why there's more of these, because it's almost saying, well, particularly with the kind of, there was two actually in the story that I did this week, which was they were sent to Sherwood Forest Hospitals Foundation Trust. There was two, so it was one of a 10-week-old and one of a 5-year-old. And within those two reports, there was real concern over the ability of the trust to kind of provide safe pediatric care for sepsis, purely because of staffing delays, overwhelmed emergency departments. And in both of those cases, there was the failure to administer treatment promptly enough. And obviously, that's led to the deaths of two very young children. And I think that's, I guess, that's the kind of blunt, reality, is that this crisis that's ongoing, that's not really being tackled effectively enough, is resulting in these deaths. And I think coroners have kind of woken up to the fact that there are these systemic issues going on.
Yeah, these are issues that are above the ability of a local organisation sometimes to address. These are intractable issues where we have, like, the pressures that we do, kind of like the, I mean, the funding, and I guess eventually it comes down to social care and not being able to discharge quicker. Well, a whole load of knit together factors, but yeah, it can sometimes seem a bit abstract, like the data on, handover delays or data on the absences, but like it's very, very tangible when it's like, yeah, we have these often avoidable sepsis deaths, or we have not just kind of stroke fatalities, but kind of stroke, people with whose lives are changed forever because stroke performance has fallen back. Why stroke performance fallen back? Because the system's not resourced to deal with what it has to deal with at the moment. Yeah, very
Both
important.
of those conditions, sorry.
One second.
Both of those conditions, so stroke and sepsis, they can cause serious harm and death if not handled and treated promptly enough. And earlier in January, I did a piece on stroke weights and how it kind of doubled, the average weight it doubled for kind of that specialist treatment. And I think when I spoke to Adrian Boyle for the sepsis piece, who's the president of ARCHEM, in February, he was very clear, and I think a lot of people are very clear. And I think it's a massive thing that we have to acknowledge, is that sepsis is very difficult to identify. Stroke is less so, but I think a lot of pressure is being put on clinicians in emergency departments to handle these really kind of difficult conditions when they don't have staff. And I think actually the kind of underlying problem is that there isn't this overarching management of sepsis. And perhaps, NHS England and Department of Health and Social Care, there was an interesting comment made actually by Ron Daniels of the Sepsis Trust in our piece out, which is out this week, about the focus on improving recognition and response for kind of deterioration, so the deterioration patient agenda, which he's been heavily involved in, and lots of these stakeholders have kind of, these big conditions are. He was actually pointing out, it's a difficult one to point out, but he was essentially saying that while they believe that Martha's Rule, so the kind of the big program that's come in quite rightly after, tragic death of Martha Mills from sepsis at King's College Hospital, and the need for a second opinion and to have that kind of advocate for families and making sure that they can seek a rapid review, which is very important. He was essentially making the point that, if there is not enough kind of efforts being made to improve the underlying issues, so poor staffing, skill mix, and other aspects, that kind of wider program, if that gets neglected, then how can you try and roll out these kind of major initiatives and also make sure that other people don't die of sepsis in a similar way? And I think that's an interesting point, but I do kind of I do think that Martha's Rule is that he's not dismissing it at all, but I think it's a point that perhaps hasn't been made, that actually that there does need to be this wider work and it can't be neglected like in the way that it has, because clearly there has been a big drop and fallback in performance that hasn't really been addressed adequately enough.
Yeah, and this is the tangible result of that. So kind of just then telling people like, oh, pay more attention, or here is a second opinion. It's like there's not the resources to deliver the current system safely. Great. But thank you. Thanks, Emily. Thank you, Emily and Joe, for joining us on this one. We're back next week. I'm not sure if the guest host is for next week, but and we'll be back in a fortnight's time. But in the meantime, yeah, if you enjoy the podcast, do let someone else know. We're available, I think, on all the places where people get podcasts, where they're available. And we'll see you another week. Thanks very much. Bye bye.